Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's feature story, we're going to talk about women in brewing. For the last few decades in the United States, beer has been thought of as primarily a drink for men. The accepted wisdom was that women preferred wine or cocktails, while men downed the six-packs. It's strange that beer has come to be seen as such a masculine beverage, when for centuries, brewing was the responsibility of women. The first written beer recipe is considered to be the Hymn to Ninkasi, circa 1800 BC. Ninkasi was the Sumerian goddess, note the goddess, not the god, of beer, and the Sumerians were one of the first peoples who left us hard evidence of beer drinking. Beer predates that recipe, though. Archaeologists have placed the first fermented beverage consumption at roughly 9,000 years ago, and the first signs of beer specifically about 4,000 years later. As I've discussed on past shows, many believe beer propelled the shift from Paleolithic to Neolithic civilization when hunter-gatherers realized they'd have to settle in one place to reliably harvest grain. Right from the start, brewing, a kitchen task, was woman's work. Both the Sumerians and the Egyptians praised beer goddesses and associated brewing with women. In addition to Ninkasi as a woman to look up to, the Sumerians also had Kubaba. She is the only woman on the Sumerians' list of kings, and she earned her ruling role not through birth, but through her work as a brewer. The Egyptians worshipped goddess of beer Menkaut and celebrated the sun god Ra's daughter, Sekhmet, whose bloodthirsty ways were calmed by beers. Even as beer became a product to sell, women remained in charge. Patty Hamrick, a writer with a master's in archaeological anthropology, teaches a class called The Archaeology of Beer. She points to the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi from Mesopotamia, one of the civilization's first set of written laws, as evidence of women's authority in beer. Quote, "The Babylonian language is a gendered language, and every time a law is listed for anything having to do with a tavern, like not overcharging for beer, every mention of a tavern owner uses she," Hamrick said. The concept of an alewife emerged around the 5th century AD. Women were making large volumes of beer for their families and often had a surplus, so they'd signal that they had extra beer for sale by placing greenery over their doors or in some cases a broom. Alewives sometimes also stood on corners to advertise, wearing tall hats, and had cats to chase the pests that ate their grain. It's theorized that the alewife image gave way to our traditional witch image. Some alewives, or brewsters, to use a female term for brewers, even set up rough versions of bars in their homes. Hamrick places the shift of brewing from women to men around the development of brewing guilds. The earliest guild was founded in London around 1200, and they existed more widely by the 1500s and were responsible for pushing women out of commercial brewing. Quote, "This is when we begin to see people making rules for how a beer is brewed, and the use of hops is becoming prevalent, so beer would last longer and you could make larger quantities at a time and ship it to different cities and countries," Hamrick said. "Beer was becoming larger scale than before," end quote. While hops and their preservative powers were the beginning of the end for women's dominance in brewing, it's believed to be a woman who first wrote about their scientific properties, says Jeffrey Pilcher, author and professor of food studies at the University of Toronto, Scarborough. Benedictine Abbess Hildegard of Bingen was a brewer and a herbalist who described using hops in beer in the 12th century AD. When beer grew from a cottage industry to a big business with an import-export trade, it was no longer in the household domain. In addition to guilds, government officials set rules to take advantage of beer's selling power. In Bruges, the first association of brewery workers met in 1447 to protect themselves from, quote, "innkeeper, woman, and provost." The innkeeper was their customer, the woman was their competitor, and the provost was the government taxman. The Industrial Revolution further improved the efficiency of brewing and shipping beer worldwide. By the dawn of the 20th century, beer production, and subsequently beer consumption, was firmly in the hands of men. Quote, "Beer became known as a man's beverage because it was made by men," says Terry Fahrendorf, a brewmaster for 3 decades and founder of the Pink Boots Society, an organization for women in the beer industry. The teamwork that had existed earlier in beer production went away, and women had a new image, demure, virginal, married. Suddenly, it may not have been so ladylike to have a beer. End quote. When Western women began entering the workforce en masse during the 1960s and 1970s, breweries became an option for employment. It's been a struggle to overcome consumer attitudes and tone-deaf marketing campaigns, from objectifying women to suggesting that they need their own special beer, but real change is happening, especially in more recent years. Quote, there are many women in the beer industry today, exponentially more than when I began my career, says Tonya Cornett, research and development brewmaster at 10 Barrel Brewing in Bend, Oregon. Women are plugging along and making a significant impact. Most female brewers I know want to be known for the quality of the beer they make, that rather than constantly focusing on the fact that they are female. End quote. Statistics are hard to come by, but a study by a Stanford University research team found that 20% of American breweries opened in 2014 had a female co-founder. Only 2% were exclusively female-owned. Furthermore, only 4% of the breweries they coded had a female head brewer or brewmaster. It's slow but steady going, and good news isn't hard to find. In 2014, Belgium got its first female Trappist brewmaster. More women are opening breweries in America's booming craft industry, and the range of jobs women are exploring in beer is expanding. On a consumer level, a recent Brewers Association study found 31% of craft beer drinkers are women, up from 29% in 2015. Women's growth in today's industry is evident in the ever-increasing membership of the Pink Boots Society. The organization started as a list of all the female brewers founder Terry Farrendorf met or heard about on a cross-country brewing trip in 2007. There were 60 people on her first list and 16 brewers and 6 beer writers at the first Pink Boots Society meeting in 2008. The society now has 2,090 members, 72 state chapters, and 13 international chapters, and they are growing at a rate of 157 new members per month. Hopefully, understanding the rich history of women in brewing will inspire the young women of today and encourage them to continue creating careers for themselves in the craft brewing industry, both around the world and here in Alaska. Up next, we'll have an interview with Nels Barnett of Cooper Landing Brewing. This is your host, Bill Howell, here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. For our second interview this month, we're lucky enough to be talking to Nels Barnett of Cooper Landing Brewing Company. Hey, Nels, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. So, hey, the big news is you're going to build a brewery, right?
We're going to have an actual real facility. Really excited about it. We've outgrown our current spot. It was a tough summer brewing one barrel at a time. So really looking forward to it.
Well, that is great news. I don't know if how many of our brewers were there when we interviewed you last year, but you were just getting started and basically in your garage. So it's great to see that the demand is such that you're looking to expand.
Yeah, absolutely. We sold every ounce of beer we made this summer, and it continues to go out the door. So been fairly well received, and I missed out on a lot of beer fests this summer because we just didn't have the beer to go. Had to leave our priorities local.
So I understand the property that you're going to be building on is by the Sunrise Inn. Can you give our listeners just a little better description of exactly where it is?
Yeah. So for most people, heading south towards Soldotna, come into Cooper Landing. And the Sunrise is on your left hand side. We're just before that on the same side of the road.
So you're going to be on the Sterling just before the Sunrise, then, if you're heading south.
Yep.
So what kind of a facility are you looking at, square foot wise and tap room size and all those kind of ideas?
Well, the footprint of the building's about 3,650 square feet, of which, you know, about half of that will be the brewery. And we'll have a tap room. I don't know the exact size right now, but, you know, something similar to Sennosier size probably. We are going to have a small kitchen, so we'll have some food, and we're going to do coffee as well.
Excellent. Your own coffee that you'll be roasting?
Yeah,
there?
We're going to we'll roast it ourselves and take it all the way.
Great. Are you planning to be open year round, or is this going to be the tap room going to be a seasonal thing? Have you thought that far ahead?
Well, it's been in the back of my mind. I'm not sure. We really wanted to get open next summer, but just the way things work, it didn't happen, or it's not going to happen. So I'm hoping that we'll have the luxury of getting it mostly put together by the end of next year, and I'll have 3 or 4 months to tinker and actually open with some confidence and not just scramble at the end. But we'll see how things go.
It sounds like your target then is spring of 2020?
Yeah, we're thinking May.
May of 2020? Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I guess what I was really asking was, once you get open, do you foresee yourself as being open year-round, or are you going to, like, follow the Seward model and
I don't think we'll go into hibernation altogether, but it's pretty slow in Cooper in the winter, so maybe
reduced hours,
maybe one
or something.
Or 2 days a week or something.
So what about your new brewing system that I'm sure you're going to get a bigger one, because I know you're tired of one barrel at a time.
We'll step it up to a 10 barrel.
Okay.
And we're looking to go all electric. A little different. There's no natural gas in Cooper Landing, of course. So propane's pretty expensive. Fuel oil's dirty. We've been talking with Stout Tanks out of Portland to design us an electric brewery.
And what about your packaging? Are you going to stick with kegs for now? Do you have any plans to move into anything else once you get your big system along?
Yeah, we'll probably start out with an entry-level canner, manual canner, and do some cans. And we'll keep the crowlers going, of course, but some canning, yeah.
And then just self-distribute to your local outlets or something along those lines?
Yeah, keep it on the peninsula for now.
So any new beers coming down the pike now that things are slowing down a little for winter that you can catch your breath?
Yeah, it's been hard to, you know, we started with 4 beers and it's getting increasingly harder and harder to stick to that number because we want to make new stuff. We made a Pilsner all summer that was really well received. I really like it. We started brewing a common or a steam beer.
Mm-hmm.
That turned out really good. Second batch is in the fermenter now. And then we're doing a smoked porter and your more traditional winter beers. Started brewing the brown again and doing the cryo camper, which is like a New England style IPA. The pale, of course. So I think I got about 7 beers now that are quote unquote mainstays. But, you know, there's only usually a couple available at a time because I'm brewing in such limited quantity.
What's your brew cycle looking like these days? Are you brewing once a week, twice a week?
I had an assistant brewer help me, which is actually my uncle, this summer. So we were doing twice a week, and that is maximum capacity for our setup now. So 2 barrels a week is what we're doing. So you can imagine it was trying times. Keep everybody happy.
Yeah, that's a lot of work for one barrel of beer.
Oh my gosh, very labor intensive.
What are you thinking about having? You're going to go for a 10-barrel system. What are you planning in the way of fermentation? I guess what I'm saying is, how much tankage you're going to have? How many batches you're going to be able to turn reasonably at a time?
So we're looking at 4 20-barrel fermenters. so we can double batch. And we are planning on the four-ish mainstay beers, we'll have serving tanks for those, so we won't keg everything.
Right.
So there'll be bright tanks in the cooler that you can see, and we'll pull from those, and then have bright tanks in the brewery too for our keg stuff. But it'll be a mixture. So, you know, thinking two batches a week is probably full tilt.
Well, two batches a week where you make 20 barrels is a lot better than two batches a week where you make two barrels.
Right, if you're dropping off the fermenter, yeah, you're, yeah, 40 kegs instead of two.
So what else? You got any other plans or anything that you want to share with our listeners? You're going to make it to the Frozen River Fest this year, you think, maybe?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we had a great time. We'll definitely do the Frozen River. Definitely go back to Haines. We had fun down there. That was great. Hope to hit more once we have the luxury of having beer for those things. Got a lot of invites this year, but I had to turn a lot of people down. So that was tough. But yeah, on the bigger, better.
All right. Well, hey, Nels, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it. You know, we wish you the best of luck. More bigger, good breweries on the peninsula is always a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're moving the family down next summer. So we'll be officially moving out of Anchorage and residing in Cooper Landing. So I'm pretty stoked about that.
All right. Sounds great. Well, once again, thanks a lot, and keep us informed about any developments. And we look forward to seeing you breaking ground in the new building going up next summer.
Yeah, we have the lot is cleared now. So hopefully people driving by will start to see progress.
All right. Well, that's great. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
All right. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and we'll be right back with our next segment. Oh, welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. This month in Beer Styles, we're going to talk about smoked beers. Smoked flavor has a long, long history in beer. Up until around 1700, most malt was kilned using some form of smoky fuel, like wood. Inevitably, the smoke emitted during the process would flavor the malt and the subsequent beer to a greater or lesser degree. It was only the development of purer fuels, such as coke and eventually modern options like natural gas, steam, or electric heated kilns, that allowed reliably smoke-free malt to be produced. Here's what Jeff Larson, one of the founders of Alaskan Brewing Company, had to say on the subject in a 2012 interview. Quote, back 200, 300 years ago, everything was filled with smoke. When smoke was referred to, it was almost always in a negative way because there was no such thing as a smokeless environment. If you had heat, you had smoke. So there was never any reference to smoke in a positive way. If there wasn't any reference to smoke, it wasn't because the smoke wasn't there. It was just at a level that was acceptable. End quote. With the exception of a few rare survivors like the Rausch beers of Bamberg in Germany, smokiness in modern beer came to be perceived as a defect, resulting from either the use of inferior material or some other mistake on the brewer's part. Of course, what was true for the more civilized parts of the world did not necessarily hold true for frontier Alaska. Here's Jeff Larson again. Most of the breweries at the turn of the century in Alaska were brewing and malting companies. I'm sure they were forced to be innovative. You're at the end of a supply chain here in Alaska. You've got a booming workforce. The miners are working 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. These same malt houses were invariably making some of the more powerful beers, porters and stouts. One particular brewery really talked about their porters. So in 1900, there were a lot of dark beers being made in Alaska. Here we are. We're in Alaska. There are dark beers and there are malting facilities, and the only hardwood around here is alder. This was a frontier town. Everybody was using wood for cooking and for heat. If you walked down the streets of Juneau in 1907, what you smelled was smoke. In a town where smoke is everywhere, it's probably in the beer. It wasn't out of place. End quote. Just like our frontier forebears, most of us modern Alaskans are familiar with smoke-flavored foods. A large portion of the population harvests our local salmon to subsist on, and they often smoke this fish to preserve it. Those who don't smoke fish themselves have plenty of opportunities to taste both homemade and commercially smoked varieties. In the mid-1980s, just across the street from the Alaskan Brewing Company, was the Taku Smokeries, owned by Sandro Lane, a business that smoked salmon using local alder wood. Jeff Larson recounts what it was like. Across the street, a friend of ours had a fish smoking operation. We'd get together routinely on a Friday afternoon. He'd bring over some of the products he had, we'd have our beer, and we'd commiserate. There was a point when we thought, boy, it would be great to make a beer touching on the history of Alaska and the fact that to get these dark roasted malts, the old maltsters were having to really crank up the heat, invariably resulting in some smoke. And here we are finding smoke is a perfectly legitimate flavor in both beer and this fish. It was an interesting investigation. He knew smoke and we knew beer and malt, so we collaborated in making part of our grain bill that would impart smoke character. With smoke, there's a real balance if it is to appeal. Cross that line and it becomes objectable. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing. But in subtle uses, it adds a dimension that is very, very enjoyable. End quote. The end result of this investigation was a beer called Chinook Porter that took the silver medal at the Great American Beer Festival in 1988. However, this beer did not stop there. Being savvy enough to recognize lightning when it strikes, Alaskan Brewing soon began to brew this porter on an annual basis and enter it each year in the Great American Beer Festival. Since its first medal in 1988, this beer, now known as Alaskan Smoke Porter, has been awarded medals at the GABF an unprecedented 21 times, more than any other beer in history, plus another 30 national or international beer awards. Every American-made smoked beer on the market today traces its genesis to a small brewery in Juneau, Alaska, with a fish smoker across the street. Jeff Larson's mastery of the smoked beer became so legendary that he was asked to write the book on it, literally. In 2000, he and co-author Ray Daniels wrote Smoked Beers, History, Brewing Techniques, Recipes, which is a part of the Classic Beer Style series published by Brewers Publications. If you are interested in sampling smoked beers produced in Alaska, here are five of the best. All of these beers are distributed in bottles to shops across Alaska, as well as being sold at their respective breweries. Alaskan Brewing Smoked Porter. First brewed in 1988 by Jeff Larson, one of the co-founders of Alaskan Brewing, and his wife Marcy, this classic ale was the first modern American smoked beer. It's a taste of history from both the Gold Rush era and the early days of craft brewing in Alaska. Each year's batch is released on November 1st, and it is famous for its ability to be aged. Cassock Brewery's Smoked Russian Imperial Stout. Located in Nikiski on the Kenai Peninsula, Cassock's Brewery is the Alaskan version of a traditional farmhouse brewery that opened in 2006. This big smoked offering took home a gold medal in the Tasting Institute's World Beer Championship. Midnight Sun Brewing's Barfly Smoked Imperial Stout and Secondhand Stout. These two smoked beers from Alaska's second oldest operating brewery are produced from the same load of grain using a traditional brewing technique known as party guile mashing. In essence, the first runoff from the grains will contain the most fermentable sugar and are used to make the stronger imperial stout. The grains are then rinsed again, but the second runoff contains less sugar, so it is used to make a plain stout. Both beers are packed with the flavors of smoke and roasted malt. 49th State Brewing's Smoked Marzen. In addition to its original location in Healy, 49th State has now opened a second brew pub in downtown Anchorage. This traditional German-style smoked lager won a gold medal at the 2015 Great American Beer Festival in the smoked beer category. We'll be right back with the last segment of our show this month. This is your host, Bill Howell, here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Calling all KDLL listeners. Would you like to have a direct voice into what you hear on the air? KDLL is seeking members for its Community Advisory Board. The CAB meets quarterly to gather public input and evaluate how well KDLL programming meets the needs of the community. If this gets your ring of approval, contact Jenny at KDLL at info@kdll.org or 283-8433.
Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here in KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And for this month's closing segment, it's time for beer gear again. It seems every time you turn around, there's another cool new app out there for your smartphone. This month on Beer Gear, I'd like to tell you about the Pint Pass app. This app is currently in private beta testing with 18,000 users, of which I am one, but it is scheduled to go live to the public on October 15th. Here's how it works. After you've downloaded the app and created a free account, whenever you visit a brewery, the app will ask you to answer a few short questions about your experience there. Once you do so, the app will deposit $2 in your account on the app. When you want to spend your money to settle a bar tab, the app generates a Pint Pass MasterCard number for you to give to the server to input. It's actually quite simple, and it really works. The app also includes a function called Text a Beer. Using it, you can send money from your Pint Pass account to a friend's account and, in effect, buy them a beer. I guess I'm a bit of a cynic when it comes to these sorts of things, but in this case, I've been pleasantly surprised as Pint Pass has actually lived up to the hype. If you think this sounds like an app you might be interested in, check out www.pintpass.com for more information. It also seems that every time you turn around, there's another new beer book being released. The latest is the Beer Bucket List, over 150 essential beer experiences from around the world by award-winning British beer writer Mark Dredge. This collection of over 150 unmissable beer experiences features Dredge's selection for the world's greatest beers, bars, breweries, and events. It's the ultimate bucket list for every beer lover. Combining travel, city guides, food, and history, the Beer Bucket List takes you around the globe via traditional old British pubs, quirky Belgian bars, brilliant Bavarian brauhouses, and spots to enjoy delicious food and beer, the hop gardens of New Zealand, Southeast Asia's buzzing streets, amazing beer festivals, unique beer styles, pioneering breweries, and the best new craft brewers. It's an experienced beer lover's take on the most essential beer experiences on the planet. It's a 224-page hardback, and it's available for just under $21. So that's it for this month's Beer on the Last Frontier. Hope you enjoyed us and that you'll be back next month when we'll have more news and stories about beer here on the peninsula and in Alaska. This month's closing quote is from the great actor Humphrey Bogart. "The problem with the world is that everyone is a few drinks behind." And on that thought, I bid you farewell for this month. Cheers.
It's fall membership drive time at KDLL, Thursday and Friday, October 11th and 12th. We've got all original, all local, special programming in store, raffle prizes, and the satisfaction of knowing you're supporting your community by keeping public radio on the air. Mark your calendar for 2 days of the best programming public radio has to offer with the KDLL Fall Membership Drive, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., October 11th and 12th.